This is a Telegraph cycling podcast live from the Tour de France, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney, and Daniel Frey. Today, we're in Cotterêts.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Frey.
Hello, chaps.
And we're coming live from the Tour de France press room. Where are we, Lionel?
Well, we're not quite in Cotterêts, are we, this evening? We're just down in a town, village, around 10 kilometres from the finish line, where all of the press set up today and where the team buses were. It's very hot here in the Pyrenees, isn't it?
Very hot in these tents that they put up as press tents as well. Sorry if there's a bit of background noise. There's a bit of shuffling around. Journalists packing up. Some of the early finishers are packing up, ready to go home for a nice dinner. Well, not home, but a hotel for a nice dinner. We tend to work a bit later, don't we, chaps?
Well, we do, yeah. I mean, we'll want to get on the road a reasonable time, won't we? Drive back to our hotel in Po for another big day in the Pyrenees tomorrow, an even bigger day in the Pyrenees.
We put in the hours. So this is our second live podcast from the Tour de France, our third one altogether, because we did Bradley Wiggins live as well. This is actually just as hot as that. That was a very hot night as well in the Velodrome in London. It's our second live podcast, so we will be discussing today's stage and then taking a few questions. We've been sent a few questions already, but if you want to send in a question, it's hashtag CPLive. So anyway, today's stage. Lionel, I think you're about to give us a little rundown of today's stage.
Yes, stage 11 of the Tour de France, won by the Polish rider Rafał Majka. Majka of the Tinkoff Saxo team won two mountain stages and the King of the Mountains jersey in last year's tour, very much the kind of plan B for Tinkoff Saxo after Alberto Contador crashed out in the on the Planche des Belles stage at the end of the first week. And after Contador's pretty disastrous day yesterday, a day that Sean Yates, the sports director at Tinkoff Saxo, described as Contador's worst day in a grand tour. Majka took off on the Tourmalet from the group he was in and went down the descent and held the gap over Serge Pauwels and held off the late rally from Ireland's Daniel Martin and won the stage.
Dan Martin second once again on the stage. He was closing the gap pretty rapidly, but that final climb maybe wasn't quite hard enough. What did you make of it, Daniel?
Well, I was just thinking that the Tourmalet, unfortunately, has been somewhat desecrated in recent years by a series of fairly turgid, uninteresting stages. Every time we seem to go over the Tourmalet these days, or most times, not an awful lot happens. And that was always likely to be the case today with the way the course was set up. It was actually a course for aggressive riders, and which lent itself to attacks, but possibly not from the GC guys, and certainly not with the quantity of with the number of mountain stages we've got coming. I mean, I think that's something that people don't really appreciate, how often, how many times during a grand tour some guys will just want to be only thinking about saving energy, not even alive to opportunities to attack. They will only be thinking about resting up as much as they can for the next day.
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit of a day of consolidation, wasn't it, for the overall contenders licking their wounds. It was another bad day for Vincenzo Nibali, though. Maybe not such a surprise. His not sure what the state of his body is, but his head doesn't seem to be here. And his team manager, Alexander Vinokourov, sorry, I was distracted there by somebody dismantling something behind me. Alexander Vinokourov said this morning in Po at the start that he needs a mechanic for his head, which was a very blunt assessment. Is he going to respond well to tough love, Daniel?
Well, I think he wanted to respond well today. He put the team to work at the front of the bunch as though he was shaping to attack, but I don't think he quite had the legs. He'll probably get better as this race goes on. I know that Nibali and Nibali's sort of immediate entourage were quite aggrieved by Vinokurov's words. And you know, whether they were designed to provoke some kind of reaction or get some kind of response out of Nibali, I'm not really sure, on the road. You can only do what your legs allow you to do, don't you? And that is Nibali's condition at the moment, what we saw today.
Team Sky, I guess, will be pleased that they didn't suffer the kind of jurissons they suffered in 2013, the day after that first day in the Pyrenees, Taxe Trois Domaines, where Froome and Port were first and second as they were yesterday, and then fell apart the following day. They had a relatively straightforward day today. Richie Port sat up on the final climb. He's well done overall, so no real benefit to him to bust a gut. You know, Geraint Thomas still up there in fifth overall. Richie Port in the polka dot jersey. Who's that? Oh, it's Chiro. Chiro might be joining us in a moment. Richie Port in the polka dot jersey, also wearing a polka dot helmet, which I wondered about the appropriateness of that, given that he's not actually really the leader of that competition.
Quite right. I think
accessorize if you're leading the competition with restraint.
Absolutely. If you're leading the competition, fair enough. But when you're just keeping it warm for Chris Froome, no polka dot helmets, I don't think. Chiro has joined us here. Chiro, Vincenzo Nibali's woes continue.
Exactly. In Italy, we call this a kind of via crucis when the things go worse and worse for him. And after the stage, he was really sad and only said, well, I have to repeat myself. I have no clue, as you say in English, so I have no explanation for what's happening to me in this day. And maybe this, the fact that he has no explanation, is even worse than his performances.
Daniel thinks that Nibali will get better as the tour goes on. Looking at him today, I'm not sure he's going to make it past Ballon.
In this case, Lionel, I agree with you and not with Daniel Fribe. And I must confess that 19% of my life I agree with Daniel Fribe. But in this case, not. And I have also a question mark in this hot, really hot afternoon, listeners, here in the Pyrenees. Vincenzo Nibali will arrive in Paris or not?
Well, that's the big question. The other thing that struck today, really, was after their terrible day yesterday, Cannondale Garmin, when Talansky and Daniel Martin were dropped in tandem, they bounced back, and Daniel Martin had a really good go on to chase down Rafał Majka. He overtook Serge Pauwels on that final climb, but he didn't really... You know, he'd made two big efforts, hadn't he? Because he had to bridge up to the break the first time. So he basically missed it first, got into the right place to be, and then missed it again. Anyone?
Well, I think he said himself that he had bad legs early in the stage, so he didn't think that it was going to be the kind of day when he would be able to attack, and then sort of changed his mind, which often happens in stages like this. Guys, I remember Andre Greipel saying a few days ago on one of the stages that he won that he felt he had terrible legs in the first 100 kilometres of the stage, and then all of a sudden they felt very good. And I think that's what happened to Dan Martin today, and there was only so much at that point that he could do.
Any more fallout today, chaps, from the dominant Sky performance the previous day? I was speaking to Charlie Wigelius at the start this morning, Cannondale Garmin Direct Sportif. He was more puzzled by his own team's performance, but we were talking about that stage, and it was a particular kind of stage, and there were definitely parallels with the Mont Ventoux stage in 2013, much poured over Ventoux stage that Chris Froome won in similar fashion, attacking almost from a similar distance to finish. And it looks like this is a sort of stage that suits him, a long, relatively straightforward run-in, and then a straight sort of time trial up a mountain. That seems to be his forte.
I think it'd be interesting to get Chiro's view on this. Chiro, what did you make of all the speculation yesterday, the rumour mongering, or call it whatever you want, about Chris Froome's power output, this file that's been released?
Well, Daniel, I must confess, this belongs to our profession of journalists, but my question is, we have to speak about rumours or about facts? I mean, our mission, in my opinion, is to speak about facts, explain the reality to our listeners. So, it's correct or not to give so much space to rumors, to speculation? I don't know the clue in this case, but in my mind, these questions are always in my mind, so you can imagine how my mind work every day, work a lot.
Well, on that point, Fiona Richard, who we stayed at her very beautiful Gite towards the end of the tour in the Périgord. She's given us a slightly hard time about the tone and language we used to describe Froome's ride yesterday. Maybe we were too negative, because she says that the sports directors and the French journalists have been much more admiring of Froome's ride yesterday.
Does she mean that, is she sort of seeing euphemisms in our use of words like extraordinary, incredible and remarkable, or what's the specific nature of the comment, please?
Well, the specific nature of the comment is, as a fan, I thought it was a great ride. Surely the joy of a long stage race is how it changes and the tactics and Sky have set it up. It's not like last year when the race was over early.
Well, very interesting chat with Charlie Wigelius on the subject. Maybe I'll record it the next time. He was very interesting about this whole, how should we respond to these performances? How should we talk about them? It's terrible that words like extraordinary, incredible, unbelievable have been tarnished, I suppose, and are now seen as euphemisms for something else, when actually in other sporting contexts they're not. There's been a question come in, sorry to change the tone a little bit, but there's been a question come in for Ciro. Ciro, if Nibali goes home early, will Ciro go home with him?
Good question, and in this case I have a clear answer. If Vincenzo Nibali goes home, I will remain here till Paris, but more important is that only 12 days left to the tour in Paris, but more important, only 14 days to start my holidays.
Okay, that was Steve Morris. Another question from Steve Jones. Ciro, and we'll return to serious business in a moment, but these are important questions while you're here, Ciro. Ciro, what is your favourite pizza and pasta? Please confess.
Also easy to answer. I'm happy because difficult questions are worst. My favorite pizza is pizza margherita. But yes, it's really a common answer. But on pizza, I have maybe the most expert, not only in Italy, in the world. And I must confess that normally I'm used to eat pizza only in some places in Naples. Because you know that I live in Milan, but for example in Milan I don't eat pizza, for example. Pasta, the exact name in English, but Daniel, he speaks more or less 10 or 12 languages, so he could help us, is spaghetti con le vongole, my favorite pasta dish.
It's spaghetti with clams.
Very nice, Ciro. My stomach was rumbling there. We're approaching Cassoulet country. Cassoulet, is that popular, Ciro?
In Italy, it's not popular. Exactly, but I don't know if it's the same thing, Daniel, similar, because yeah. I know that you are really an expert also of cooking and kitchen. Certainly, I didn't know, but it's also good to know this. And I'm not really fond of the Cassoulet. You, Lionel, maybe?
I love it, yeah, I love it. Should we get back to the Tour de France, maybe?
Serious questions. Okay, Colin Hunter asks, hashtag CPLive. Now, I think Daniel and Ciro are having an argument in Italian. That could be slightly distracting. Colin Hunter asks, would there have been the same hullabaloo if Alberto Nibbles or Quintana had ridden away the like Froome did on yesterday's stage? Would there have been the same hullabaloo?
To some extent. I mean, there are two problems with Froome. I think one is the superiority, and two, probably more reasonably, is what people conceive and construe as his transformation post, 2011. I mean, we've told the story before. At the 2011 Vuelta a España, Dave Brailsford had pretty much given up on Chris Froome at the start of that race and was fully prepared to see him leave the team at the end of that year. And then we all know how everything changed. He finished second in that race, and produced performances that bore no relation whatsoever to what we'd seen in 2010. But let's not forget, in 2010, he also came, or certainly those who knew Brailsford's thoughts about Froome and the team's thoughts about Froome, he came with a reputation as a very, very powerful rider and a real raw talent. That said, his results prior to 2010 were not that impressive. It was all untapped potential, really unrefined potential.
Oh, absolutely. And I remember in the run-up to the Beijing Olympics in 2008, when the road race was on a very hilly course, and British Cycling had discovered this completely unknown talent, Chris Froome. They worked out that he was eligible to ride for Britain. He, at that time, I think, had a Kenyan race licence. But I remember talking to Doug Daly, who was, quite a senior figure in British cycling at the time. And he was more or less saying, we found a guy who we think has the sort of raw ability to win a medal in the road race at the Olympic Games. And nobody had ever heard of him at that time. And obviously his development was slow and unconventional, perhaps. I mean, he took time to develop in the kind of pro team system. Remember, even at Barlow World, he was like, he was just sort of, one of a number of people in a team. They weren't really a cohesive unit. I think when he first joined Sky in 2010, he found the adjustment to a very much more sort of regimented way of training and racing, completely difficult to come to terms with.
Next question, Hayden Baudry, I think is the pronunciation, asks, do you think that one day the Yates brothers, Simon and Adam, who ride for Orica Greenedge, will be good enough to win the Tour de France? Lionel?
Very possibly, yeah. I mean, it could be that there's a race between them to see who develops first and who gets on the podium first. I mean, the first job is for one of them to win a stage. And you might rule Simon out because he's been ill. He may recover, of course, in time for the transitional stage and the Alpine stages. But you wouldn't rule out Adam Yates getting in the right move on any of the days between now and Alpe d'Huez and potentially winning a stage.
It's impossible to tell, isn't it? I mean, the time trialling, I think, is the thing that's going to count against them. They're not. I don't think they're good time trialists. I mean, Simon Yates, I think, is a little bit more of a rounded rider than Adam Yates. He's spent a bit of time on the track. He's former world points champion on the track. Adam Yates spent that time in France in the amateur scene, riding a lot in the Alps. That's where he found out that he was a good climber. And I don't know if I mentioned this already, but I found out recently that he was in Troyes for a bit as well, in Champagne country, where he rode for the same club as a lot of former British riders, going all the way back to Robert Miller and his mentor at in I think it's UVC Aube in Troyes. His mentor was a man called Jacques André, who was also the mentor of Robert Miller and many other British riders. And they remind me a bit of Robert Miller, the two of them. They're both kind of slightly insular, very single-minded, very focused, very driven climbers. Ciro.
Yes, just to summarize this tour, because in my opinion it's easy, and unfortunately this is the last thing that I will say for this podcast edition. We talked about at the very beginning Fab Four: Nibali, Quintana, Froome, Contador. Maybe at a certain moment we thought to the big five with Van Gardner, but at the end, dear listeners, this tour is one-man show by Chris Froome.
Okay, before you go, Ciro, can I ask you one? I've got one more question for you that's come in. Two more. Can I ask you two more quickly? Sorry, are you in a rush? Are you in a rush?
No.
Okay, quickly. Please ask Ciro, ask Matt Lundy, please ask Ciro if he likes cycling.
Yes, but as I told once, always in the podcast, listeners, not in the first 10 priority of my life.
Okay, so you like a lot of things then. You're very, you've got an eclectic taste.
And the second one?
Question, quickly. This is a serious question, Ciro. Ciro, what are the most and least promising signs in Italian doping culture? Do you think there's still a big doping problem in Italy? There was news today of a couple of positive tests at the Italian National Road Race Championships.
Well, yes, it's a serious question, and it's also difficult to answer. In this case, the positive seems to be only one, Francesco Reda. I want to say the truth to our listeners, because I'm obliged to. I'm not sure that the doping culture is completely far from Italy. Do you know what I mean?
You mean it's not just Italy?
No. It's not. No, for sure, it's not just Italy. It's not just Italy. But I'm not sure that the doping culture no longer exists in Italy. This is the problem. I can't compare. It's also difficult to compare to other periods. Maybe other periods of cycling in Italy were dirty more than this period. But I'm not sure of this.
none of us are sure, are we? That's the problem. Bye, Ciro.
Ciro is contractually obliged to only make 4 contributions to any one edition of the Cycling Podcast. That's his time up.
And he jogs away.
Yeah. Just before we go back to questions, I'll talk a little bit more about today's stage and just thinking about how hot it was out there and how many riders were suffering in the heat. I mean, Romain Bardet certainly was reported that he was suffering in the heat, was vomiting and had been given some ice to put down the back of his jersey. It's days like this that really take their toll, isn't it? I mean, and if it's hot again tomorrow and then hot all the way across the south. Last night I wasn't that hopeful that there would be any chinks in Chris Froome's armour. I think it probably came across in last night's episode that I felt like the overall race was kind of done and dusted. But having slept on it and reflected on looked at the GC again and just seen, you know, Sky do look very good, but the Tour de France, there's a long, long way to go, and the hot weather is going to, you know, cause some surprises, isn't it?
Yep. And I have in my mind, the image I have in my mind is this, a pendulum that starts at the foot of the Pierre Saint-Martin, the foot of the Col de Soude yesterday, and it ends on Alpe d'Huez. And today it started swinging back from Chris Froome. It's still very much in Chris Froome's favour, but at a certain point in the Alps, who knows, it might swing past the 90 degree point and start to point in the favour of Nairo Quintana.
Sorry to return to the question, just a quick one from Martin Shaw. What can Sky do to prove they race clean? Richard to shadow the team. I don't know if that's tongue-in-cheek. The problem is that journalists have even less credibility than cyclists. That's a serious point. I think a lot of people don't believe journalists and they don't believe cyclists. So when you've got journalists backing up cyclists, that's not a great scenario. I just read a tweet earlier actually from Richie Porte, who said that he was accused of being a doper by a roadside fan today on his way back to the bus, and he stopped and had an exchange with them. I'd have quite liked to have witnessed that.
We must remember that. It's a good way to get an interview, isn't it? From a lot of riders, just ride straight doper.
Ride
straight past us in the morning.
Doper. No, but the serious point was something that Daniel mentioned last night, that Froome camp is actually being active in trying to get a proper physiologist. I know they've approached one very eminent physiologist, very respected man in his field, who may be able to work with him after the tour, and we don't know if that will happen or not, but they seem to be quite proactive in trying to find a way. They've tried the journalist approach with David Walsh. David Walsh shadowed Team Sky for a year and wrote a book, Inside Team Sky. Also ghost wrote Chris Froome's autobiography. He's been on the record several times saying he believes Froome is clean. They've tried that. A lot of people won't accept it because journalists stock, even somebody like David Walsh, who did such great work in exposing Lance Armstrong, our stock as a profession is pretty low. Politicians, cyclists and journalists are right down there.
Estate agents as well. Sorry, estate agents, if you're out there listening. Nothing personal.
And in the last 24 hours, we've heard a lot of terms, innuendo-laced terms like extraterrestrial and freak, and it's pretty clear what people mean when they use that kind of terminology. But I said yesterday that these supposedly incriminating files, this power data, I think there are some interesting things going on physiologically with Chris Froome, whether he's doping or not. I mean, he said in the press conference tonight that his maximum heart rate is in the 160s, which is incredibly low. And actually, we've seen, I've certainly heard of freaks before who have been incredible athletes who have got exceptionally high maximum heart rates that go to 210 or almost up to 220, you know, even when they're in their 20s and 30s. So I was certainly shocked by that. And that's certainly something that is worth, I'm sure, investigating and explaining to the general public.
But heart rate is purely an individual thing. You cannot compare heart rates.
Rare. But to have a maximum heart rate in your 20s or at 30 years of age of 160 is very, very rare, and that would also explain why when he attacked on Mont Ventoux, supposedly his heart rate went from 157 to 160 because it was already at its maximum.
Yeah, it is very rare. He apparently has a very large heart, but as soon as you start seeing things like this, there are echoes of Lance Armstrong talking about his exceptionally large lungs. I remember Miguel Indurain, you know, when he was time trialing, the explanation for his little paunch used to be that he had, his large lungs were pushing his stomach out. I'm not sure about that. I know that's Lionel.
Yeah, my large stomach is definitely the result of a huge lung capacity. Anyway, we made a Bastille Day resolution yesterday that we wouldn't sort of chew over the Chris Froome credibility aspect of the Tour de France until there's some kind of other development or something new to add. So I've got a good one here, perhaps. Does it now look like a mistake for Contador to have ridden and won the Route du Sud after the Giro d'Italia, or should he have just had a nice, you know, a break and done some sort of active recovery, you know, training?
I wouldn't have thought so. I think if anyone knows his body and if anyone knows how to ride Grand Tours and how to prepare for Grand Tours now, it's Alberto Contador. He's been doing this for a decade now, and if he raced at the Route du Sud and he raced hard at the Route du Sud, I would suggest that's because he knew that that is the best approach for him. I mean, I pointed out in the podcast before the Tour de France, he has never done particularly well, or he's never sustained the same level over two back-to-back Grand Tours, i.e. Giro plus Tour or Tour plus Vuelta.
Here's another one. It's disappeared off your screen there, Richard, but I think it was, has Warren Barguil benefited from not being in a French team? And that's from Liam Brown. Daniel again?
Well, I think he has, absolutely. And I think he knew exactly why he was going to benefit from not being in a French team. I think he knew that he would be able to get on with his work quietly, away from the hype, away from the spotlight in a foreign team. That's been the case. But I think Giant Alpecin, more generally, do an exceptional job of developing talent. They've got really clear ideas. I was talking to a Dutch journalist the other day. Of course, that used to be a Dutch team until this year, Giant Alpecin. And he talked about how the other major Dutch team, Lotto Jumbo NL, I don't know if I mentioned this on the podcast the other day, but they have become slightly obsessed with copying Team Sky. And because Team Sky, the most successful team around at the moment, and trying to mimic and ape everything that they're doing. But Giant Alpecin are quite different in the sense that they have their own path, their own ideas, their own convictions, and the strength of those convictions. And the way they've developed Barguil, not selecting him for the Tour de France last year, really demonstrates that. And, you know, he's riding a superb Tour, rode a fantastic race again today, you know, was clearly struggling, could easily have fallen off the back and fallen into oblivion, really, as far as the general classification is concerned, but just rode at his own pace and showed a very level head to finish with Froome. I think he finished in that group in the end.
He did indeed, yeah. Right, let's. Here's another one about the injured riders. There have been a lot of riders who've struggled on. If you look at the last, the Alex Dowsett came in third from last. He's still suffering the effects of the elbow wound, and probably more pertinently, the blood he lost in that accident. Adam Hansen is still battling on, I think. The Tour lost today Johan van Summeren, who was a rider who was caught up in one of those bad crashes in the first week. Rui Costa also out, Daniele Bernardi also out. But the question here is there anything to be gained for riders with somebody like Adam Hansen carrying on? You know, he's got tape holding his collarbone in place. He's obviously got this record of Grand Tours that he's ridden to try and keep up, so no doubt he wants to go on to Paris. But in terms of injured riders, Alex Dowsett said the other day, you know, being a sort of burden on the team, you know, taking up their medical resources, taking up a space when he's not able to contribute on the road. I suppose it's a difficult balancing act, isn't it?
Well, it does, and it can also go the other way, in the sense that I'm not sure if this made the editor's cut on my Crashes Kilometre Zero podcast this morning, but I think Adam Hansen made the opposite point, that, you know, it's very difficult to sit at home and see your teammates struggling and knowing that, you know, you could maybe contribute in a tiny way instead of, you know, sitting at home injured or whatever. But also, I think the thing that when you speak to riders, they say again and again about this, is that it's such a big decision to quit the Tour and for there to be no way back. And it's kind of unique in professional sport that can happen. You know, if you're injured in the Football World Cup or whatever, you sit out a game, but you can always come back in, whereas the Tour, it is so final when you do that, and there is always the chance that you will feel better in 3 or 4 days and regret your decision. And you know, also contracts are at stake. It's a big decision in that respect as well.
2 points. I mean, I think the Tour is so long that a rider who's crashed in the first week does have a realistic chance of recovering and coming good in the third week, even though obviously the body's not healing as well as it would if you're resting. And Daniel mentioned that how big a decision it is to pack the Tour, pack any race really, but you know, the status of a rider, you're in those guys who are riding the race are they're really looked after, they're supported, all they have to do is ride their bikes. The minute they pack the race, their status changes completely, and I think it can be humiliating for riders to pack the race. You feel guilty, and I think you are very aware. It's a bit like taking a sickie from work when you phone in with the old handkerchief over the receiver and pretend to sound ill. There's always a suspicion. You think that others are going to think that you didn't give it your all, and that you could have gone on, and you've taken the easy way out.
Well, no,
that's a horrible position to be in.
Yeah, nobody takes a sickie from the cycling podcast by putting a hanky over the phone receiver. But Daniel, I think, is taking a day off from. I don't know whether this is confirmed yet or whether we should perhaps put this in the public domain. But the question coming in is, what is it with Lance Armstrong? This is from Sue Tyler. What is it with Lance Armstrong and with the media spending time with him? I just don't get it.
It's a good question, isn't it? Sometimes it's a. Well, we think about this ourselves, and sometimes we struggle to come up with an answer. The bottom line is, I think that we view things through a different prism to a lot of fans, and we look for stories. We've got our minds are tuned to quotes and sound bites, how things are going to come across, and basically that is our currency. That is what we deal in, and there is no one better than Lance Armstrong. He is the Bank of Zurich when it comes to quote sound bites, great copy, and you know, whereas a lot of the riders here on the Tour de France are more like the Bank of Greece.
if we bump into him at all, this was a discussion we had last night, should we give him a Pedlar de Charme t-shirt? I think that was after a bottle of wine. It was a completely ridiculous, it was a non-starter, that absolutely no way. We would have to add ne pas in there somewhere.
Pedaler sans charme.
Yeah, that'd be more difficult though with the old black marker pen. But you know, if we were to, we won't. Honestly, listeners, we're not going to present him with a Pedaler de Charme t-shirt. We wouldn't besmirch the jersey.
But we may have a kilometre zero next week on this whole issue, this whole story. Obviously, Lance Armstrong coming to the Tour. I think, Richard, you've spoken to David Walsh about that. So that will be coming next week, hopefully. So, we've been on air 32 minutes 50. The wonders of the internet, we're not a radio program, we haven't got to get ourselves up to the news or the travel or the,
I think the weather's coming in.
The weather is scorching hot, the traffic is going to be bad all the way back to Poe.
Just talking about riders who don't enjoy being interviewed, I had a quick word with, or I was in a little huddle with, the German national champion who came third today, Emmanuel Buchmann, 22 years old, neo pro, riding his first Tour de France, finished third in one of the major Pyrenean stages. He was absolutely terrified of speaking to the press, absolutely petrified, almost trembling when he came down the steps of the bus today. But obviously a very, very good rider. Yesterday even did a good ride, but finished the stage with a puncture and was protecting his team leader, Dominic Nertz, who pulled out today. So Buchmann has some freedom now. He's not going to pull up any trees on general classification, but I think we'll see him in a break again. He's obviously a very talented rider. I'm not necessarily going to suggest that he's the next Jan Ulrich, but
I think the next Leo Koenig, same team. He could. Well, the evolution of that team.
Indeed. Well, I'm very much anti-predictions and guessing what's going to happen, but we have got the Plateau de Bay stage.
Negative, Lionel. I mean, you'll predict that the traffic will be very heavy between here and Pau, happily. When I say happily, I mean miserably.
Well, that's because I've looked on Google Maps and I've seen that the traffic is very heavy between here and Pau. But that's fine. That's fine. We'll be having a nice dinner shortly. But lastly, Plateau de Bay, certainly the hardest of the three stages, because the final climb is so hard and there are climbs before it. What are we expecting to see?
I think it will be a shootout between the GC guys. I don't expect a break to stay clear that day. There are too many teams that are really focusing on that day. Well, there are certainly Movistar and Sky will certainly focus on trying to control the race that day. If Movistar have good legs, or if Quintana has good legs, I think they'll be on the front. And it's just a brutally hard day and a horrible, horrible climb. Much more difficult, in my view, than Alpe d'Huez. It's probably the hardest climb in the race.
Oh, I think Quintana will be better tomorrow. I'll also be interested in looking at just see how many Basque fans there are, because since the Euskaltel team disappeared a couple of years ago, that was always such strong orange support for the Basque team. And yeah,
it's funny we associate Plata de Bay with that, because I think we all have the same memory of 2004 yeah. of immense Basque crowds, but yeah. it's not actually that close to the Basque country. The climb, for instance, yesterday Pierre Saint-Martin was very well situated for the yeah. for the Basque country, and there weren't that many Basque fans, were there?
I think 2004 became a focal point also because Ivan Mayo was riding that tour with, they thought, a possibility of winning. I was on the mountain that day wearing a kilt with some Scottish friends as a fan, and we got a lot of respect from the Basques, who sort of thought we were separatists because we were wearing kilts. I'm not a separatist, no, but we were wearing our kilts, and but we obviously didn't go into politics with them. We just raised our fists and cheered back and went, yeah, yeah,
vamos.
Yeah, 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 totally, go Basque country. Anyway, that was
got on very well with Ivan Mayo when you met him. Was it last year?
A year and a
bond
half
there.
Ago.
There was
a year and a half ago. I was had lunch in Bilbao with Ivan Mayo. That was a chapter in the cycling anthology. A very entertaining lunch that was. It lasted from 1 o'clock until 5:30.
Well, shall we call it a day there, then, chaps? There's a truck beeping in the background. That's a truck reversing. They'll be starting to dismantle this press tent here. We'll be heading off to Po to get a delicious dinner. No hold-ups in the traffic, surely.
If we don't get a delicious dinner, Daniel's always got some cheese in the boot.
Yeah, Daniel spent one day in our Jaguar car and already left a piece of half-eaten cheese in the boot in 38-degree temperatures.
One more tweet, because it's very funny, it made me laugh. Tickle Mouse says, if you see Lance Armstrong, the T-shirt you should give him is a Chiro, I must confess.
Oh, very good, yes, very good. Well, that's about it then, isn't it, for tonight's live edition of the Cycling Podcast. We're back tomorrow with a non-live edition from Plateau de Bay. Daniel may or may not be here. I'm thinking may not be here.
A dead edition.
Dead edition, yeah, a non-live edition. And look out for Kilometre Zero in the morning in all the usual places, on Audio Boom, on our website, thecyclingpodcast.com, and on iTunes. It will be a sideways look at the Tour de France. So,
that's all. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thanks.
For the best analysis, discussions and interviews from the 2015 Tour de France, listen to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.